And hello, SunSouth listeners. This is Andy Bobick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for a little over 2 months, titled The 57 Bus. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Brave. And then it's Clyde the Greyhound, The Walk, Perfect, and if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Scare Sighted on the First Day of School. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today titled Brave. Braids are brave. My mom combs my hair every morning, and we talk. She tells me about how she longed to have long hair when she was my age. I wince at the tugging and wiggle while she untangles knots. Sometimes it hurts, but having long hair makes me feel strong. Sometimes I want to cry, but I try to be brave. As I watch my dad put his hair in a ponytail, I hope my hair grows long like his. He tells me how men traditionally wore their long hair. I always admire the beautiful hair of the dancers at the intertribal powwows. I hope one day I will be able to do the same and wear braids down to my waist like ribbons of valor. When school starts, things change. Kids pull my hair and tease me over my braid, but I decide to be brave. I imagine my ancestors are there with me, and I tell the kids to stop. When I stand up for myself, I feel like I've battled a monster and won. My dad is so proud to teach us our traditional ways, to let our hair grow long, to stand up for what we believe in, and to be brave. But when I get teased at school, my mom is the one who has to speak with the teachers about our traditions. My dad becomes so angry about it, he loses his words. That night, my dad sits down with me before bedtime. He tells me that the school he went to made him cut his hair. His parents sent him to private school because they thought it would protect him. But it didn't protect him. When he grew up, my dad made a choice to grow his hair again. He tells me I had to teach myself how to be brave. Be brave when they slap your hand with a ruler made of the oak trees that used to grow here and feed us. Be brave when they force you to sing, even though they won't let you speak your language on your own land. Be brave when you stand there against the walls built of adobe clay by the calloused hands of your ancestors. Be the bravest person you can be. Your ancestors' strength is inside you. I didn't know my grandpa or great-grandpa, but my dad tells me more about them that night. They lived in a time when they were not allowed to practice their traditions, to grow their hair long, or to show their bravery, he begins. Instead, they were called braves, and their hair was cut, and they cried for what they lost. My grandpa grew up with that sadness and fear. But he remembered the stories his father told him and remembered his words, "Be brave." My grandpa lied about his age and joined the military. They cut his hair. He did not cry. He showed no fear. He was a warrior who wore no braids. My dad tells me having long hair is a promise to wake up every day and take pride in who you are. It connects us to our ancestors and our traditions. My father explains, when you were small, your hair grew slowly and knotted easily. I'd try to braid your fine strands as they fought to unravel. They would often buck loose, and you would take off like the wind and run free again. You are my wild one. I want long hair like yours one day, I tell him. I want to be the bravest kid in the world. I think you are braver than me, he says. When I became your father, I decided to let you grow your hair. I promised to never cut it unless you ask me to. I want you to live without the fear others might try to put on your shoulders. I want you to fill with happiness when you see your reflection, knowing your long hair is beautiful, knowing that you are brave and strong. I want you to feel loved and comfortable with who you are, always. I sit on my dad's lap, patient, as he combs my sun-kissed strands of gold, which will probably turn dark like his when I get older. You are the newest brave one in the generations of brave men and women who have tried their best to stand up for the things they believe in, he tells me. You are strong, you are brave, you are loved. Clyde the Greyhound. It was a rainy evening when Clyde arrived with Lucy's dad. Lucy couldn't believe it. His tail, an elegant creature with his curious eyes and stunning black coat, was all hers. Lucy stretched out her hand to say hello. Clyde approached her slowly and greeted her with a gentle nudge from his pointy nose. Clyde, like most adopted greyhounds, was an ex-racing dog. Luckily for Lucy, Clyde was no longer winning, and so his racing days were over. While being a racing dog might sound glamorous, life was harsh at the racetrack, and Clyde was a little rough around the edges. Lucy got to work. She sent Clyde to be pampered at the doggy groomers. She ordered Clyde a stunning selection of designer outfits. Lucy decided Clyde needed to see his amazing transformation for himself. Admiring her work, Lucy realized there was only one little thing that still needed improvement. The next day, while having brunch at her favorite cafe, Lucy presented Clyde a special gift, something she had chosen all by herself, something she thought was perfect for him, a brand new collar displaying his brand new name, Chino. As time went by, Chino's life became ever more glamorous. He was fed only the finest organic dog food. He was spoiled with the most high-tech, next-generation canine toys. Chino had a social media account with a growing following that seemed enthralled by his every move. He even had exclusive membership to some very well-heeled clubs. It wasn't long before Chino was rubbing muzzles with the most popular dogs in the neighborhood. But no matter how hard Chino tried, he couldn't quite get used to his new life. Something was not right. Sometimes Chino felt a bit like a square dog in a round hole. So Chino did something he'd never done before. He set off on a walk, alone. Without a destination in mind, Chino roamed the streets for hours, until he froze with fear, smelling old familiar smells and hearing hauntedly familiar sounds. The gloomy gates of the racetrack towered over him. At the racetrack, dogs don't live in loving families. They live in cages. They're not bred for pats and cuddles. They're bred to win. Chino ran until it grew dark. Now nothing was familiar. Chino was lost. Chino shivered himself to sleep in the only dry spot he could find. He dreamed about his cozy and warm rainbow-striped crochet jumper, about his satisfying organic meals, about cuddles with Lucy. He missed home. Chino woke, startled by footsteps closing in on him, and saw a menacing sight. "We found you," said a familiar voice. Lucy hugged him tight and whispered, "We missed you." Safe and comfortable at home, Lucy presented Chino another gift. This time, something old. It was the best gift he'd ever received. And he's wearing a collar that says Clyde. The walk. My granny is taking me on the walk. Because leaders are not born, she says. They're made through molding and modeling. What's the walk? I ask. You'll see. And there's a few treasured souls coming too. She packed my backpack, water, sandwiches. I fetch her cane, and we walk on. We stop around the corner. Are we here? I ask. Not yet. A woman pushes a walker down the driveway. Ready? Granny asks. Every time I take this walk, the woman says, I feel like it's 1972 all over again. I shut the gate, and we walk on. Red, white, blue swirls in a cylinder. Granny smushes her face against the big window. It's the barber shop. Tap, tap, tap. She raises her right thumb. So, we hear? I ask. A wave of men stroll outside. They're prepared and waiting. Ready? Granny asks. Yes, ma'am. The man flips the closed sign. You know, I thought after 2008 I could skip a few of these walks, but I see we need them more than ever. You're right about that, Granny says. Now, let's go collect the rest of these treasured souls. And we walk on. We stop at Mrs. Wong's. Tap, tap, tap. We hear now? Finally, I say. Hello, everyone, Mrs. Wong says. This is my granddaughter. Say hello, Man Ying. Man Ying waves and smiles. I wave and smile back. Mrs. Wong holds Granny's hand. Man Ying holds my hand, and we walk on. More stops, blocks and boulevards, circles, courts, cul-de-sacs, and a Catholic church on a corner. Me doing the smushing, me doing the tap, tap, tap. More people, a sea of faces swimming upstream, like a school of fish. We walk on, traveling in a group, talking like family, together, a community. The street is getting noisy and busy. Hustle, bustle, clattering, chattering. People in cars, people on foot. Red signs, blue signs, honk, honk, beep, beep. When will we be there, I ask. We've been walking forever. The walk wasn't always this long, Granny says, but folks keep making it longer. They don't want us to say what we have to say. That's why we have to show up, show out, and show them. Please tell me no more walking, I say. My legs hurt. Granny giggles. We're here. You're silly, Granny, I say. There's no school today. School is always in session, baby, and today the lesson is for the community. It's like a big test we cannot miss. All these treasured souls today, we're voting. And that's what she's doing. Your school is our poll site. It's where we came to vote. I walk with Granny into the booth. Why do people vote? I ask. For hope, baby, Granny says. For hope. Also, you know how me and your mama teach you to speak up? I nod. Well, voting is how grown folks speak up. It's how we stand up and say what's on our minds. I stand on my tippy toes, reading the names, and watch Granny black out the bubbles and drop the ballot in the box. When she's done, we both get a sticker. I voted. Then we sit on the side, waiting on everybody to finish, speaking up, standing up, saying what's on their minds. And when they come out again, we head back up the street, back to where we came from, our sea of faces dwindling, until it's me and Granny and the lady with the walker. And when the lady with the walker opens her gate and disappears, I take Granny's hand, kiss her fingers, and we walk on. Perfect. Miki Amelia Masuda liked everything to be perfect. She only ate whole round cookies, not the broken ones. When she fell and tore her favorite pants, she refused to wear them anymore. And after she accidentally left Owlie in the park, her little stuffed owl, she told her parents, "I'm too old for stuffed animals. I'm a big girl now." But the truth was, Owlie was missing a wing when she had found him that the next morning. And he was no longer perfect. One day, when Miki's grandmother, her Obachan, came over for a visit, she brought Miki a present. It was a teacup from Japan. "My best friend is a potter," Obachan told her. "She made only two like this. She sent me one, but I want you to have it." The teacup was cool and heavier than other cups Miki had used before. It was white on top, like the clouds, and blue on the bottom, like the ocean. It reminded her of a recent vacation at the beach, the most perfect place Miki had ever been. "Thank you, Obachan. It's perfect." As the days went on, Miki loved drinking from her new teacup. The juice from it tasted sweeter, the milk colder. Even plain water was more refreshing. But then one evening after dinner, when Miki was carrying her dishes to the sink like she always did, the teacup slipped from her fingers. "No!" Miki screamed as she rushed to pick up the pieces. "It's ruined!" "Don't worry," Obachan said as she stepped in front of Miki. "It can be fixed." "It won't be the same," Miki fussed. "Don't worry," Obachan repeated as she walked away. Miki moped for days. No matter what, her precious teacup would never be perfect again. What if it leaked? What if she could still see the cracks? She wanted to snuggle Owlie to help her feel better, but then she remembered his missing wing. She burst into tears. She continued to cry until she remembered something Obachan had said. There were two. Her grandmother's friend had made two teacups. She would just ask Obachan to get the other one. She dried her tears with her sleeve, though it was not nearly as comforting as Owlie. When Obachan stepped by again, Miki was so excited she almost knocked her over. "Careful," her grandmother gently scolded. "Wouldn't want this to break again. I just fixed it." It was fixed. But not really fixed. Not one bit. Miki could see all the places where it had broken, like Obuchan hadn't even tried to make it perfect again, like she was showing off the cracks. Golden lines ringed across the blue. Golden lines zagged across the white. Before Miki could say a word, her grandmother explained, "It's called Kintsugi. It means to join together with gold." Kin, Miki had never heard this word before. "That's right," Obuchan nodded. "Kin means gold, and Tsuji means to join." Miki still wasn't sure she understood. "It's too bad your teacup broke. It was an accident, though, and everyone has those. You drank from it every day because you loved it, right?" Miki nodded. "And there are plenty of unbroken cups you haven't even touched that stay in the cabinet. Ni?" Miki was beginning to understand, maybe. She took the teacup from Obuchan and gazed at the white that reminded her of the clouds and the blue that reminded her of the ocean. She thought about her trip to the beach, the most perfect place she'd ever been. Miki remembered one evening there when it stormed. The blue waves turned dark and roared across the sand as lightning zapped through the sky. From safe inside the cottage, the beach was no longer sunny and calm, but it was still beautiful. Miki traced the golden lines that crisscrossed her teacup like the lightning from that night. Miki turned the cup over in her hands. It felt cool and heavy, just like when she first held it. "It's still perfect," Miki exclaimed, forgetting all about asking for the other teacup. "Ah, nothing is perfect, Miki-chan," her grandmother laughed. "But I'm glad you like it." Miki looked up at the wrinkles around her Obuchan's eyes that crinkled when she smiled, and she finally understood. Miki set her teacup down carefully and ran to her room. From under her bed, she grabbed her favorite pants with the hole. From her closet, she grabbed Owly with his lone wing. She brought them to her grandmother. "Do you think you could help me fix these too?" Obuchan held up the pants. "Well, I was flying a kite, and it went higher than I'd ever flown it before," Miki explained. "But then I tripped." "You were trying hard to keep the kite up in the sky," Obuchan said, nodding. "You were having fun. There's nothing wrong with that." Obuchan brought the family sewing kit in from the living room. "What color was the kite?" "Red," Miki answered. Obuchan helped her sew a patch, the color of poppies, over the hole. "And what do you think happened to Owly's wing?" Obuchan asked as she pulled a clean handkerchief from her pocket. Miki stared into his eyes, and he told her. "He battled with the big squirrel bully at the park." "Is that so?" Obuchan's eyes grew wide. "But Owly defeated him," added Miki with a smile. "This new wing will remind us of his bravery," Obuchan said as she stitched a small purple heart onto the handkerchief. Just then, Miki's stomach growled. "Want a snack?" Miki asked, because all this fixing suddenly made her very hungry. "That would be nice," Obuchan answered. Miki returned from the kitchen with a bag of cookies. But when she looked inside it, there was only one. "That's all right," Obuchan smiled. "You should have it." "No," said Miki as she broke the cookie in two. "We both can." "Delicious," Obuchan said as she crunched one half. "The best," Miki agreed as she munched the other. Miki Amelia Masuda liked everything to be perfect. She used to, anyway. But then she learned that broken cookies taste just as good as whole ones. That her favorite pants looked pretty cool with the poppy red kite patch over the knee. That Owlie was still great at cuddling after a rough day. And that the golden streaks on her teacup somehow made each sip more perfect than the one before. And I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled Scare-Sighted on the First Day of School. It's the first day of school. I'm feeling so scare-sighted. 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 I'm both scared and excited. I can't believe it's here. I really like my outfit. I'm looking pretty flute. Flute. I'm looking fly and cute. Pose, smile, twirl. There are so many kids here. I feel a little curious, curious, curious. I'm feeling shy but curious. Will I make a friend? Roll call. It's Afwa here. My teacher said my name wrong. I'm feeling so sad-barrassed. 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 I feel sad and embarrassed. Why is my name so hard? At least we're making slime in science. I love slime. It's so slicky, slicky. It's slippery and icky. Slime always makes me smile. Uh-oh, my stomach growled. I hope I don't get too hangry. Hangry. When I'm hungry, I get angry. Is lunchtime coming soon? Now I'm feeling pretty spappy. Spappy. I feel special and happy. I think I made a friend. I ate mac and cheese, my fave. Now I'm feeling kinda sloughed. Sloughed. I'm feeling sleepy and I'm stuffed. I could use a nap. But it's recess. I love recess. I'm feeling pretty strongfident. Strongfident. I feel strong and confident. Ready, set, go. Great race, Ifu-ah. She said my name right. Should I correct the teacher? I'm feeling kind of brave. Bravis. I feel brave but nervous. My heart's pounding fast. Here I go. Excuse me, Miss Lane. My name is pronounced Ifu-ah. I did it. Why do I feel so Bired. Bired. I feel better, but I'm tired. That was really hard. Thank you for correcting me, Afua. I'm glad you spoke up. Her words helped me feel pre-lieved. Pre-lieved. I'm both proud and relieved. I stood up for myself. School's out. Bye, Afua. I feel a little smarter, prouder, braver, and also just excited. What will tomorrow bring? And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bommack, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel I've been reading now for a little over 2 months, titled The 57 Bus. A true story of two teenagers and the crime that changed their lives. One teenager in a skirt, one teenager with a lighter, one moment that changes both of their lives forever. If it weren't for the 57 bus, Sasha and Richard never would have met. Both were high school students in Oakland, California, one of the most diverse cities in the country. But they inhabited different worlds. Sasha lived in the middle-class foothills and attended a small private school. Richard lived in the economically challenged flatlands and attended a large public one. After school each day, their paths overlapped on the bus for a mere 8 minutes. But one afternoon, a single reckless act left Sasha severely burned and Richard charged with 2 hate crimes and facing life imprisonment. The case garnered international attention, thrusting both teenagers into the spotlight. But in the 57 bus, author Daishika Slater shows that what might at first seem like a simple matter of right and wrong, justice and injustice, victim and criminal, is something more complicated and far more heartbreaking. This true story, first chronicled in the New York Times Magazine by Slater and artfully, compassionately, and expertly expanded upon here, is a riveting exploration of race, class, gender, identity, mortality, and forgiveness, told with honesty and insight gleaned from both teens' lives. The 57 bus will inspire you to rethink all you know about crime, punishment, and empathy. Okay, last week I recounted how Richard lit Sasha's skirt on fire on the 57 bus. Everyone got off the bus. The driver had no idea what was happening. Richard walked to Sasha but didn't say anything and got back on another bus. Sasha called her dad to pick her up. He picked up Sasha and they drove to the hospital. Sasha had third-degree burns on over 22% of her body. Richard wanted to talk to Caprice, the school counselor, the next day, but couldn't. Caprice saw police officers at school take Richard away. And that's where I left off last week. I knew my baby. Jasmine was watching television when she saw that police had arrested a suspect in the bus passenger burning that had been all over the news. The newscaster didn't say a name, nor did the broadcast show the suspect's face. But Jasmine's heart began pounding all the same. The TV showed the boy's back as he was marched in handcuffs up the steps of the police department. White jeans, black hoodie, the same clothes Richard had worn to school that morning. "I knew my baby as soon as I seen him," she said. "As soon as I saw his body, I saw his structure, I knew exactly who it was." She called Caprice, who confirmed that Richard had been arrested. Then she began calling everyone she could think of: Richard's father, his probation officer, the police station. No one could tell her where he was. And so she sat and watched the news and waited for someone to contact her. Richard never called. He called his father instead, maybe because he didn't want to face his mother's disappointment. By the time Jasmine was allowed to see him, 6 days later, the district attorney had decided to charge Richard as an adult, and his name was all over the news. The Interview, Part 1. When Richard arrived at the police station on the day of his arrest, the officers placed him in Interview Room 202 and instructed him to remove his shoelaces, belt, bandana, and the cord from his hoodie. Then they left him there. The room was small and shabby, containing only a rectangular table and 3 chairs with blue plastic seats. The plaster was pitted and peeling. Pieces littered the floor as if someone had recently punched the wall, and no one had bothered sweeping up afterward. Richard leaned forward and rested his forehead on the edge of the table. Minutes ticked by. He sat up and rubbed his eyes with two fingers, leaned back in the chair and stared at the floor, leaned forward with his chin resting on his arms, cradled his head in his hand, sat up and rested his chin in his palms. 10 minutes went by, then 20, 30. After an hour, an officer peeked in to hand him a bag lunch. He unpacked it, a soda, a turkey sandwich, a bag of Sun Chips. He smoothed the paper bag flat and placed the sandwich on top. Then he folded his hands and bowed his head. He crossed himself 3 times. Then he ate the sandwich. He had his head down on the table when Officer Anwan Jones and Jason Anderson came in, 2 hours and 19 minutes after he'd first been placed in the room. They moved him into the center seat and settled themselves on either side of him. "You didn't eat all your chips, man?" Officer Jones asked. He was tall and African-American, with a shaved head, glasses, and an easy, sympathetic manner. "I was getting a little stomach ache," Richard said. The officers assured him that they wanted to keep things relaxed. They asked about Richard's life, where he lived, what sports he played. "How are you doing in school?" Officer Jones asked. "I was doing okay," Richard admitted, "but then it started falling off. The school's not good for me. There's too many distractions. I need to go to a smaller environment where I can focus." "A lot of kids wouldn't understand that," Officer Jones said, nodding. "I had the same issue when I was younger." "Any girlfriend right now?" asked Officer Anderson. He was white and heavy set, and though he smiled a lot, his friendliness seemed forced. "Well, I've been looking," Richard said. "Looking?" Anderson grinned. "On the prowl?" "Well, it's not looking too good," Richard said. "Were there girls up in Redding?" Anderson asked. "They cool?" Richard looked puzzled. He'd been in a group home up there, he explained, and hadn't been allowed to mix with girls. Jones sat with one hand resting on his knee, the other on his writing pad. "Did you learn something in the group home? Did you learn some important lessons being away from your family?" "It was hard," Richard admitted. "It took me, actually, a while. And then I was doing good. And then my best friend since forever, my best friend ever," he paused. "And then I had a little breakdown." "What happened to your friend?" Jones asked. "He was murdered." As the conversation continued, Richard was candid, almost confiding. He told them about getting robbed, about how he had been set up by someone he'd called a friend. "I have trust issues right now," he told the officers. "Well, here's a deal," Officer Jones said at last. "I'm going to explain to you why you're in here. We have some questions we wanted to ask you, so we can get your side of the story, your version of what transpired. But before we get into that, I need you to read your rights." Miranda warning. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to talk to a lawyer and have him present with you while you are being questioned. If you cannot afford a lawyer, one will be appointed to represent you before any questioning. Do you understand the rights I have explained to you? "Why did you talk?" Jasmine asked Richard later. "You should have waited until you talked to either me or your father or a lawyer." But studies show that more than 90% of juveniles who are interrogated by police don't wait to talk to an attorney and don't understand the rights the police have read them. They do what Richard did. They talk. Kids are not going to spontaneously ask for a parent, explains Barry Feld, a law professor at the University of Minnesota and one of the nation's leading experts on juvenile justice. They're embarrassed. They're ashamed. They're thinking in their adolescent brains that somehow their parents won't find out. They're thinking, how do I get out of here? They read him his rights, and they ask him, did he understand? He didn't understand, Jasmine says. And I know he didn't understand because I could barely understand. When we're in court, I don't know nothing until the lawyer tells me. The interview, part two. You have a pretty good memory, right? Officer Jones asked when he finished reading Richard his rights. Give me the rundown of what you were doing, say, yesterday, after, say, school. From the time school got out till, say, about 8 to 9 o'clock at night. Richard told him about Lloyd meeting him at the gate at the end of the school day and about going with him to get a phone from someone, a process that had taken close to 2 hours. Then he described getting on the bus and how there was a man on the bus wearing a skirt. He'd just gotten off the 57 bus to get the express bus, he said, when he heard screams and ran back. When they opened the door to the bus, he saw that the man's skirt was on fire. What do you think about dudes who dress up in skirts? Jones asked. I'm not with that, Richard said. I wouldn't say that I hate gay people, but I'm very homophobic. Jones nodded. Okay, why would you call yourself homophobic? I don't have no problem with somebody if they like men, but, like, if you do too much? Nobody cares, really. Do too much? Taking it to the next level, Richard explained. Jones asked for an example of the next level. Cross-dressing and, like, some people, like they try to make everybody know that they are that and they try to do too much and it's just a lot. Jones spun his pencil in circles on his notepad like a spinner for a board game. A lot of people share the same views, he said. People who display stuff outwardly for everybody to see. Then he asked Richard to go through the events on the bus again. I think there's a couple parts where you haven't been completely honest with us, he said when Richard finished. You're a good kid. I like people to be honest with me. We're going to be honest with you. I expect people to be honest with me. He asked Richard to describe what he and Lloyd and Jamal had been wearing on the bus the day before. Then he slid some photographs across the table. Richard, Lloyd, Jamal. Richard picked them up, looked them over. It's pretty obvious we have some pictures, Jones said, tucking the pictures under his notebook. And mind you, these are not still pictures. These are pictures from video. Both of the buses you were on, they have audio and video cameras, Anderson asked. With that in mind, I want you to take a quick second, and I want you to rethink the story that you told us, and I want you to tell us what really happened. You're not a bad kid, Anderson said. Sometimes we make decisions that are not the best decisions. Keeping in mind that you know we have video, and the video shows everything that happened on that bus, everything. Right now is a time in your life when you've got to decide, am I going to take responsibility for my actions? Am I going to be honest? Because that dude on the bus whose skirt caught on fire got burned pretty good. Can I see the video? Richard asked. The interview, part three. They only showed him a short snippet of the video. But it was enough. Richard slumped in his chair, one hand shoved in his pocket. "Why would you set that dress on fire?" Officer Anderson asked. Being stupid, Richard's voice was low. "What was going through your mind?" "Nothing." "Have you done this before?" "No." "What would even remotely make you think about setting something on fire like that?" "Someone's clothing," Anderson persisted. "That dude got seriously burned. It's not like he went home. He's awaiting surgery at a San Francisco burn center right now. He got burned real bad." "What was going through your mind when you decided to light that dress on fire?" "Nothing." It was a whisper now. "Was it because the dude was wearing a dress? Did you have a problem with him?" "I don't know." "People do things for a reason," the officer said. "We all made decisions in life that may not have been the best choice to make at a given time. What we're trying to figure out is why this happened." "I'm homophobic," Richard said at last. "I don't like gay people." "Really? And you had a problem seeing him on the bus?" "I don't know what was going through my head," Richard said. "I just reacted." "Did Jamal or your cousin Lloyd tell you to do it?" "No." "I know you said you didn't know what was going through your mind," Officer Jones said. "But did you get angry because he's a gay dude in a skirt? Not just being gay, but doing too much?" "Actually, I really didn't know that his skirt was going to do that. I didn't know that it was going to catch like that," Richard blurted. "It was like a little flame. I thought it was just going to go out." But it was too late to backpedal. On the charging documents, Officer Jones wrote in black capitals, "During SUSP interview, the SUSP stated he did it because he was homophobic." A man in a kilt. The news spread quickly, first to local media, then national, then international. A man wearing a kilt-like garment was set on fire as he slept on a public bus in Oakland, California, during evening commuter hours, Reuters News Service reported. A passenger on an Oakland, California public bus received burns to his legs after his kilt was set on fire, UPI wrote. The word kilt seemed to have gotten lodged in the minds of reporters. It was in every port as if Sasha had been on the way home from bagpipe practice. The Daily Mail in the United Kingdom even illustrated the report with a photo of a kilt, explaining that a kilt is the national dress of Scotland. It felt wrong to Debbie. Sasha wasn't wearing a kilt. They were wearing a skirt, and she was pretty certain that the skirt was the reason Sasha had been set on fire. So when a reporter showed up on her doorstep, she began to explain. "My son considers himself agender," she said. "He likes to wear a skirt. It's his statement. That's how he feels comfortable dressing." It wasn't until later that she realized she'd gotten the pronouns wrong. "Is this real?" Healy Instant messaged Michael at 9:16 p.m. on Tuesday, November the 5th. "Healy, how are you?" "Michael, mixed. And you?" "Healy," tapping a random assortment of keys. "Foe has just piv schism." "Michael, huh-uh?" "Healy, yeah, you understand?" "It finally kind of hit me in physics class." "Healy, it hit me in science, but I didn't want to cry, although I did. But then, also, when I saw it on the news, like, this is real, this is not fake, there are people I've never met who've seen this. There are probably people who I've met at cons or talked to on the internet or something who watched and were like that fucking crazy. It's horrifying. Michael, yeah. Did you hear that Sasha's cousin started a fundraiser to help pay for the medical bills? Healy, yes, I saw it. It has already raised about 2 G's. Michael, nice. Healy, I don't know. I guess that they are responding to text. Just an FYI. Michael, they are? What makes you think this? Healy, yes, they responded to one of Nemo's. Although they may not be tonight, BC, their first surgery is tomorrow. Michael, Sasha must be medicated out of their mind. Healy, you want to know a fun fact? People's typing generally gets worse if they start crying. Michael, well, I'm glad that they're in contact. I left a message on Sasha's phone earlier. Healy, yes, me too. I did, and I sent them a really long text. Michael, ah, now I feel like I should do something else. Healy, yes, well, I am a worry type person. Wait, that shouldn't make you feel bad. Don't feel bad. Michael, so I was going to start on the bio essays tonight. Healy, me too, but I haven't. Michael, but there's no way I'll be able to focus. Healy, yeah, I got basically nothing done tonight. Michael, I want to ask Sham for an extension, but I feel like that would be profiteering off of Sasha's injury. Healy, yes, I thought of that, but it seems unfair and I refuse to. I'd rather just stay up late. Well, not rather per se. It just seems a better option / more moral option. Something like that. Are you really okay? I don't think you're okay, as you want everyone to think. Michael, I'm not sure what I feel like. My emotions are changing wildly minute to minute. Healy, yeah, I don't know. I just feel kind of numb now. Michael, one second I'm getting ready to bawl my eyes out. The next, I'm somber. I don't want to do anything right now. Homework? No. Cookie clicker? No. I want to share a link to a news article about Sasha, but I'm not sure what I'd write, and I kind of just don't want to talk about it on Facebook. Healy, yeah, everything just feels wrong. Did you watch the video I sent? I thought it was okay. You? Michael, yeah, that guy at the end was kind of odd. I think it might have been due to video games. That guy was weird. Healy, yeah, he was. I don't like him. We don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure it was a hate crime. IDK, about you, weirdo. Michael, yeah, there's pretty much no way that it wasn't. Healy, uh-huh. I must go. Enjoy your night. Michael, yeah, right. Sleep well. Booked in. The squad car pulls into the Sallyport at the side of Alameda County Juvenile Hall, and the officers escort you into the booking room. A sign on the wall says, all personnel property removed in this area, including piercings, wigs, and detachable hair pieces. The police have already taken your personal belongings and put them in a bag with your name on it. Now, a juvenile hall staffer asked the cop to remove your handcuffs. Take off your shoes, the staffer instructs. He pats you down and has you walk through the view scan metal detector, which will locate any hidden weapons. Another sign explains, notice, we do not return cigarettes, lighters, matches, tools, knives, drugs, gang-related paraphernalia, or any item deemed inappropriate for minors. They take your clothes and hand you the replacements: khaki pants, green undershirt, charcoal gray sweatshirt, underclothes, white bra and panties for girls, white boxers for boys, white socks for everyone, boxy black shoes, plus sliders for the shower. You can take a shower now if you want. Most people do. Chances are you've been sweating. When you're dressed, you'll go into the holding tank. There are five of them, concrete slabs, boxes with the walls painted white. Nothing in there but a stainless steel sink and toilet and a call box so you can communicate with the staff. You might be alone in there, or if it's a busy day, you might be with someone else. They check to make sure they don't put two kids together who have a pre-texting beef. They don't want fights. Once they locate your paperwork, they'll start booking you in. You get two phone calls, one to a parent or guardian, the other to your employer if you have a job, or your probation officer if you're on probation. Then you get a medical screening. Are you on any medication? Any injuries in the last 24 hours? They'll offer you an HIV test and, if you're a girl, a pregnancy test. If you've been here before, you already have a medical file. They'll thumb through it, checking up. How's your asthma, they might ask. And unfortunately, this is where we're going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there and encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, The 57 Bus. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.